Okay, hello everybody and welcome to another One-Liner podcast. Sorry about the wait, it's been somewhat stymied by the fact that there's not an awful lot in the cinema to watch. I'm Scott Morris, and joining me from Falkirk is Drew Dandale.
Hello.
And, yeah, as I say, February, March in the UK, not a good time to be anywhere near a cinema. They do tend to be full of absolute rubbish. As such, there's not been an awful lot that we wanted to talk about, so instead we've decided to go back to some of the top Oscar contenders that we've missed of late and have a look at them and have a little bit of a chat about them. First off is a film, a documentary called Taxi to the Dark Side. Drew, would you do the honours?
I will. Alex Gibney's award-winning documentary uses the tale of Dilawar, an Afghan taxi driver, as the jumping-off point for an exploration of the methods employed by the US government in their search for intelligence in their so-called war on terror. Dilawar was abducted and taken into US military custody while out driving his taxi. Denied the rights supposedly guaranteed to all under the Geneva Convention, he was beaten, interrogated and tortured and died in military custody. Even had he been guilty, this would have been unacceptable, but as he was entirely innocent, it's nothing short of criminal and an outrage. In an act of pure contempt, the death certificate given to his family along with his body, written in English so they could not understand it, clearly stated murder as the cause of death. Only when a New York Times reporter investigated the story were the family made aware of the truth. Through interview, including some with those responsible for torturing Dilawar and others in his predicament, official documents, photographic evidence, court judgments and the like, Taxi to the Dark Side explores the US government's reprehensible policies on torture and interrogation, its disregard for the Geneva Convention, its excuses for and defences of its policies, and their supporters and opponents.
Yeah, I mean, this film, case specifics aside, is not really telling you a great deal that you didn't already know. If you've been paying attention to the rampant march of American imperialism and their military's ill-advised regression to the techniques of the Spanish Inquisition.
So if you're familiar with any of the Abu Ghraib story, then you should be familiar with a lot of the material covered in the film. Well, it's no less shocking for it.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, like I said earlier in discussions earlier, this is one of the few films I've had to watch in shifts. I had to stop watching it because it was making me so angry that I couldn't really concentrate on it anymore. There's a red mist going down before my eyes and I was trying to smash things. It's an alarming thing, and it's also very strange when you start hearing people having serious conversations as to whether waterboarding is actually torture or not, which is roughly akin to the debate over whether stabbing someone in the face really counts as assault.
It's, I get angry about a lot of things a lot of the time, but few things have made me quite as angry as this film. And there's one bit, I mean, I was all sick, feeling sick and angry at the same time when it's suggested to a politician, I think, that the US government were acting like it's appropriate to threaten a prisoner with crushing the testicles of his child as a method to extract information from him.
Yeah.
It's one of the most reprehensible, disgusting things I have ever heard.
Yeah, America does seem to have based its interrogation policy on what would Jack Bauer do? It's not quite appropriate in the real world.
No.
It's quite enjoyable when you're watching 24, but you can't, I mean, I'm sure there was points of this where they were seriously holding up 24 as going, well, it works for him. Like, oh yes, because it's a television programme.
Yeah, so what they were saying, and it's really rather frightening, is that a lot of the US public had been polled asking whether they thought torture was acceptable, and they seemed to be suggesting that programmes like 24 had made it acceptable because they saw it week in, week out. And I don't really think you can seriously suggest a television programme's going to make people think torture's okay, or if it is, then the country's in a much sorrier state than I thought.
Yeah, it's an absolutely infuriating film. As I say, if you've been paying attention, it's perhaps not vital. You already know this. You may not know about the specific case of this Anwar fellow, but if you haven't seen it, good grief, this will be infuriating.
The incredible injustice, that's one of the things that makes me angriest and frustrated, because you can never do anything about it. The injustice, and as I said, I mean, had Dilawar been guilty, it's still wrong to torture people. You know, I think some people have accused the story of being very one-sided, but you can't really have a balanced view. Torture's wrong. Any right-thinking individual knows torture's wrong.
Yes, it's baffling to me. I was watching something actually just today. It had the Supreme Court Justice Scalia, the new guy, one of Bush's boys, and he was sitting down, seriously suggesting, pointed to him as whether what was going on in Abu Ghraib was cruel and unusual punishment, and at which point he might as well, it's not torture, because you can't really say that it's punishment if you're just trying to get information from them. So it's okay to do whatever you like. So It's not the fact that it's cruel and unusual or anything like that that was bothering them. It's fact, okay, it's not punishment, so it's okay to, you know, wire up the testicles to electrodes and that sort of thing. It's all perfectly legal and above board. And this duplicity of all these people, and it's come out since, of course, that the methods of torture and, you know, stress positions and all these other nice little euphemisms that you have for what is this, in effect, torture, was decided by, you know, Condoleezza Rice and Bush and all the rest of them at the highest level. There's no real plausible deniability here. Everyone in the top Bush government knows what it is. And if this sounds like it's devolving into Bush bashing, then yes, that's what it is, because, God damn it, the man's an absolute jackass.
Again, you can't really have a balanced view. It has to be one side, because there is no argument on the other side. This is wrong, and he's an idiot.
No, I went on the side as well. It's necessary, because we need information, and it just isn't. It simply isn't. If you disagree with that, then just stop listening to me now and go away, because you're clearly not human. Come back when you're not from the planet, fuckwit.
Yes, well, in fact, stop listening now. Stop breathing. 2 hours without oxygen would be suitable for you.
I highly recommend watching this film. If you're in the UK, it's been out in the... was shown on the BBC in a short form. I believe that it was actually going to come out for a cinematic release in a slightly extended version. I believe that'll be coming out over here.
Yes, it's May, I believe.
So that's something to look out for. We'll no doubt mention it again closer to the time, but yes, definitely worth watching.
But be prepared to be very, very, very angry.
Yeah, not a pleasing film to listen about.
No, but certainly worthwhile. Very, very worthwhile. Okay, next we move on to Bob Dylan-inspired film I'm Not There. And Scott, you'd like to tell us about that?
I watched the film, it was quite pretentious.
Right, I'll stop now. My knowledge going into this film was pretty much limited to it's a Bob Dylan biopic. What was missing from that summary is on crack, angel dust and horse tranquilizers. For sanity's sake, I'll abbreviate it thus, it's more like 4 or 5 individual tales told as though each significant segment of Bob Dylan's life was actually playing out through an entirely different person. As such, we get folks including Heath Ledger, Christian Bale, and, quite bizarrely, Cate Blanchett, taking the role of the nasal folk-pop rockstar. I can't recall offhand another film that has quite so blatantly walked up to you, shook you in the hand, and introduced itself as being so extraordinarily pretentious. As a piece of filmmaking, it's so obscurely high concept that you'd be forgiven to thinking it was a film student's first crazy idea, but I suppose writer-director Todd Haynes has prior in the form of Velvet Goldmine. Even despite this film doing its best to be utterly impenetrable at me from the outset, I was almost buying into this arthouse nonsense, up until the point where Richard Gere shows up as an ageing Billy the Kid in a town full of kids wearing Halloween outfits with local wildlife consisting of giraffes and ostriches.
Oh, I forgot about the giraffes.
At which point the phrase, fuck this noise, brings up something tonight. I like Bob Dylan generally, but I don't know an awful lot about him. I had hoped that this film might help that, but it's so purposely oddball and contradictory that you're left none the wiser. I'm sure that those familiar with Dylan's life and a higher tolerance for this kind of arthouse frippery may get more out of this, but it's certainly not one for casual film fans. Maybe Haynes feels that Dylan is too complex a character to fit into a neat 2-hour bundle, hence this variable mess, but I can't help but think that the smart option may have been not to have bothered at all.
Yes, one of the problems with this film, other than its ridiculous high concept messy nonsense, is that with each different actor meant to be playing a different aspect of Bob Dylan's personality, you really need to know an awful lot about him. You must have to read a lot of books, a lot of interviews, and really follow Dylan's career for a long time to really appreciate it, because not one of them, other than in the way perhaps their speech and mannerisms are, would be suggestive of anything of a person in a way that you'd learn from it. If you're familiar with his work, perhaps read books on him, then you might understand different aspects. But if you don't really know that much about him, if you wanted to learn something about him, you're never going to get it from this film. And really what you want to do is watch Martin Scorsese's No Direction Home instead. And even if you do know a lot of things about Bob Dylan, you probably want to watch Martin Scorsese's No Direction Home instead. Because it's like a proper film by a proper filmmaker and doesn't have Cate Blanchett playing Bob Dylan, which was the most astonishingly pretentious part of it. Although, curiously, her sections were the most cohesive and interesting.
I'm not sure about that, to be honest with you. it's 2 hours of people mumbling. And Possibly Kate Blanchett, for some reason, gets more screen time than anyone else, which is perhaps why it would say that, but it still has completely random left-field moments where there's you know the bit where the Beatles show up out of the blue.
And there's sort of squeaky voices and they're rolling around on the ground with her.
Yeah.
Yes.
What? Why? Who?
Oh, no, I said... It's the most cohesive, but that's relative to the rest of the film. But,
yeah, it's the least worst of a bad bunch.
Yes, especially the sessions where she's been interviewed with the newspaper reporter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at those points, I was finding it reasonably interesting. I thought that was more cohesive because that was more of an exploration of the character, and that was quite enjoying. But then it just got crazy again, and then brought in Richard Gere, who I don't like at the best of times, but to have him added to this ridiculous, pretentious movie, and a giraffe. Do one.
Another inexplicable giraffe. It's the death knell to any film. When you see a giraffe wandering about for no particularly good reason, you just know it's time to check out.
Yes.
Yeah, I like that you're saying. The bits on that interview do seem to be the only meat in this film. The rest of it's just puff. But even then, you can't really take anything away from it, because by that point, it's been so contradictory that even when you're not entirely sure what it's trying to say. If you did figure it out, it probably wouldn't be true anyway. So
yes, quite possibly.
So as any sort of documentary of anything at all, it's a complete failure. I assume it's only got onto this list on style alone. It does have moments that are at least imaginative, but certainly none of it makes a lick of sense. This was dreadful. I hated this film. Let's say for about 45 minutes or so, I was at least going along with it, but even then, I was sort of grinding my teeth at points, thinking, this is just getting silly, and it proceeded to get sillier and sillier and sillier to the point where it just gave up on it completely.
I know. I mean, within about 5 minutes of the film, I was hating it, and it lessened somewhat in the middle, because at least, as I was saying, the interview with the reporter was somewhat interesting, but after that, it just returned to hatred. And I was desperate to finish, and I wasn't going to pull out the DVD player anytime soon. I was determined to watch it to the end, but it wasn't a rewarding experience at all. So I think the recommendation from the oneliner.com should be, don't watch this, watch No Direction Home.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, at this time we would like to welcome to the conversation Craig Eastman. That is hello in Craig's speech. Anything you'd like to tell us, Craig? Anything you'd like to review? Colours, perhaps?
I've been looking at Heliotrope quite a bit this week.
What did you make of it?
Hugely satisfactory. Well, I think I wasn't all that enamoured by the trailer for Heliotrope when I saw it a few months back. I thought, this looks a bit pretentious, really. It's a bit too vibrant, a bit too in your face. I just felt like it was trying too hard to grab your attention immediately. But it's actually having now seen Heliotrope, and I've seen it a couple of times now. I was forced to watch it more than once. It's actually, there's some hidden depth there, actually, underneath the sort of the shiny, almost child-friendly facade of it, that sort of immediate, I'm a colour that's out trying to grab you. Do you know what I mean? There's actually some hidden subtlety under there.
There's undercurrents.
A couple of the plot strands could have done with some judicious trimming here and there. There's some extraneous stuff that I felt could have done without. There were some references to Teal there and things that some people might have found a little bit obtuse, but no, overall I was quite pleased with it. I would even go so far as to say I'll probably buy it when it comes out.
Oh, strong recommendations indeed.
I think the Dulux edition they're working on has got a pretty strong transfer, so yeah, it's, I'm not sure about added bonus content, but Heliotrope, highly recommended.
We were just going to talk about Lars and the Real Girl. I don't know if it's going to be as good as Heliotrope, but...
You say it'd be a struggle.
Would that be Craig Gillespie's offbeat comedy drama about a delusional young guy who strikes up an unconventional relationship with a doll he finds?
That sounds quite a lot like it.
Sweet! Why don't you guys tell me more?
Okay. I shall tell you more.
Ooh.
Lars and the Real Girl is a story of a painfully, cripplingly shy young man, played by Ryan Gosling, who lives through choice in the garage of his brother's house. He goes to extremes to avoid human interaction, especially physical contact, rebuffing even the earnest and very well-intentioned efforts of his brother's wife, Emily Mortimer, to get him to join her and his brother and spend time with the only family he has. particularly awkward around women, except for the more elderly members of the church's congregation. His brother and his wife are unsurprisingly shocked when he comes to their door one evening announcing he has a girlfriend and asking if she can stay in their house, it being irreconcilable with his religious morality to share a house with her. This shock is swiftly usurped by a much greater one when they discover that his girlfriend, Bianca, arrived in a shipping crate and is in fact a life-sized, lifelike sex doll called a real doll. The primary purpose of such a creation is not to ever uppermost in Lars' mind, and he instead suffers from the delusion that Bianca is a walking, talking, living doll, as real as he himself is, and he begins a very committed relationship with her. Taking advice from the local Dr. Dagmar, don't ask me, I didn't give the character a name, Dagmar, nonetheless, his family and the rest of his unbelievably supportive community go out of their way to accommodate Lars and Bianca, to allow him time to work out whatever demons it is that have caused his delusional state. Is that enough more for you?
Possibly too much.
Dagmar.
Dagmar.
Does he like dags?
I was going to say, it sounds like something from Snatch. We got you, Dagmar.
It's a woman, that's the thing. Dagmar, played by Patricia Clarkson. That, the local doctor's name is Dagmar.
Patricia Clarkson, the owner of the most annoying face-stroke-voice combination on the planet, isn't she?
I can't like Patricia Clarkson, actually.
Hello, Wendy Alexander.
Yeah, touché.
Talking about this film, if there's one thing that even the most disinterested of passing wee gold man observers have noticed, it's that the wee gold man loves him some mental illness. And this is yet another film that just tries to teach us that crazy people are awesome.
They're so misunderstood.
It's the usual nonsense of the, and lo, it comes to pass that the crazy person teaches us that more about the values of love and friendship and so forth and so on, and the way that only crazy people in films can. I'm not sure how much I like this film. I know the first half hour I thought it really struggled to find its stride, and I was pretty much ready to turn off after about, I don't know, 40 minutes. But after that, it kind of, it sort of grows on you like a mould. It's likeable enough in the end. It's at least earnestly played by everyone involved. It's obviously not even slightly realistic. The only thing I come up with is that this community is so isolated and so bored, and this is the only slightly interesting thing that's happened, is that they're just going along and playing with it just for the hell of it.
Certainly, that was the biggest problem I had with the film.
Very unrealistic.
The biggest problem I had with the film was that the entire community, almost without exception, is rallied round to accommodate this man believing that a sex doll is a real thing, to the point where they arrange jobs for her and times to spend away from Lars, which is sort of, it's kind of amusing, but it's also, I mean, it's touching, and there's a particularly good scene where Emily Mortimer goes off in one to scream at Lars, telling him that he's so much loved by the community that they're doing these things for his girlfriend. And it's touching, but it's like, yeah, it's really, really hard to think anybody would do that. And the fact that even his family were doing it is sometimes a stretch, but the entire community accepting this and going out of their way to help him just seems like chronic boredom. Or they live in some sort of fairy tale land.
See, what would really happen is people would just grab him by his shoulder and go, Lars, stop being a dick.
Snap out of it.
Get over yourself, man.
Pull yourself together.
And apart from that,
go into the corner and have a quiet word with yourself.
There's that, which means that it doesn't really work as a story, but it's still enjoyable. I'd find it quite sweet all along without being over the top. And for the most part, Ryan Gosling plays it very earnestly, which is needed to make the character and his predicament believable, although the two things sort of work to undermine that. There's almost a smirk playing over his face in some scenes, which makes him, it had me thinking he's just having an almighty joke on them all. I don't know whether it was just unfortunate this smirk appeared in his face or he was trying to convey something else. But it did give you the impression, yeah, he's just taking the piss in a quite stupendous style.
And the other thing, just have a bit of sweet corn stuck in his teeth.
The other thing that sort of undermines slightly Lars's earnestness is something that had the most awful moustache. A very bad hair choice, and the worst hair since Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men, although this time in his face instead of his head. But other than that, it's quite a sweet film. Certainly I would recommend seeing it.
Yeah. Highlight is definitely the variety of utterly shocked reactions when Bianca makes her first appearance. There are some classic double takes. It's an alright film. I have no real complaints about it. It's mildly recommended, but again, I'm going to trot this line out again. We've said it quite a lot lately. Oscar contender? Really?
Absolutely not. It's very much like Juno in that respect. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, it's quite a sweet film. It's enjoyable, certainly, and there's some moments of genuine humour in it and genuine pathos too. And it's enjoyable. You won't regret watching it, but it's certainly not an Oscar contender.
It sounds to me like a subplot.
As we've discussed before, though, apart from There Will Be Blood and probably Taxi the Dark Side, there are no Oscar contenders this year that were in contention for the Oscars.
True. Very true.
I was gonna say, it just sounds to me like a subplot from Death at a Funeral or something. Oh, look who's turned up. It's Cousin Lars and his sex doll who he thinks is a real woman. I don't know. I feel like it's the kind of film that should intrigue me, but it doesn't. I have it here. Yeah. I'm not going to watch it. Can't lie to you. I have no opinion.
It's the kind of film, I think, if you stumble across it, fine. I don't think it's really worth actively seeking out should you have any trouble doing it. I think it's just been released in the last couple of weeks in the UK here, on a fairly limited release. It's certainly not worth making a car journey of any length to actually go and see it, if you know what I mean.
Fair enough. Guys, what else? Tell me about some other stuff that you've seen that I haven't.
Some other films? Like Atonement? Yes. The best film of the year, according to the BAFTA bigwigs?
That's a filmy film.
I'll tell you about that then.
If you must.
Do.
Well, let me say, up for at least in Oscar in contention, it certainly won the BAFTA as Best Film of the Year. Surprising then how insufferably dull, in a stiff upper-lipped, repressed English sort of way, the first half hour of it is, to the point that I'd reduce myself to practicing chords on the Guitar Hero controller to stave off boredom. Possibly a little sad to admit that, but it was certainly a lot more fun than watching it. Does, I guess, get a little bit better later on, but not by much.
I would disagree there. I would say it just didn't get better at all. Sorry, I've interrupted you. Carry on.
Kicks off pre-World War II, looking at a family of toffs, one of whom is Cecilia Tallis, played by the so-thin-as-to-be-two-dimensional Keira Knightley. She has a patchy relationship with working local-class kid done good, Robbie Turner, played by James McAvoy, who's put through Oxford Uni on the Tallis family dime. Things take a twist when the younger Tallis sister, Bryony, sees something untoward, leading to Robbie being imprisoned for a crime he did not commit.
Oh, he should have called Robert McCall.
Well, he promptly escapes from a maximum security stockade to the Los Angeles underground. Today, still wanted by the government, he survives as a soldier of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find him, maybe you can hire Robbie Turner. Well, okay, didn't so much escape from Chokey as be drafted into the army at the onset of World War II. A few years later, you find him stumbling around France during the suboptimal aftermath of the Battle of France, making his way to Dunkirk for a lift home while Cecilia works as a nurse. You get a series of flashbacks which you recover how Robbie's and Cecilia's relationship has or has not progressed, and whether or not Bryony atones for her errors. Ooh, do you see what I've done there? Clever. Now, as far as I'm concerned, there's about 10 minutes or so of, truly great film here. The last 10 is actually quite good, I think. I suspect Drew's about to disagree with me, however, but...
You'd be correct, yes.
I like the last 10 minutes. The first half hour is borderline insufferable. The whole middle portion in the war drama is merely adequate. Neither Knightley or McAvoy do much noteworthy, although I'm not going to say anything particularly derogatory about them. They're pretty much as you'd expect from Keira Knightley, and McAvoy's okay. There's nothing noteworthy in the directions, and, war is hell, in case everyone had forgotten and needed the 12 millionth reminder. It's very, very much not the best film of last year. How
by
on
quite
earth,
some margin.
I mean, simply because it has British people on it does not make it the best film, even with British people in it, of the year. So what BAFTA were smoking, I do not know. I'm going to say it's kind of worth through the early slogs for the last 10. I think the last 10 minutes are actually quite good. Unfortunately, I can't actually say what's going to happen in them because, that would kind of spoil it. But, Drew, disagree with me.
Okay, Scott, I disagree with you. I just thought the whole film was a bust. I'd be quite looking forward to it because of... Yes.
Oh dear, carry on.
I had been quite looking forward to watching it because it had won the BAFTA and because of the press it'd gotten. But once again, I was fooled. And nothing happens. The characters are not even so much two-dimensional as one-dimensional. There's no characterization at all. So they just sort of stand around being...
Hang on. Several people were thoroughly described as being posh.
Yes. Particularly
they were Kieran. Thoroughly described as being complete stereotypes. What's wrong with you, Drew? Is that not good enough for you these days?
Well, you know, it depends. If there's robot monkeys, I'll put up with it. The film lacked robot monkeys, especially giant killer robot monkeys, so they couldn't get away with it. Kieran Knightley and James McAvoy, particularly, the characters are one-dimensional. You find out nothing about them. The characters don't develop at all. So quite similar, you have not one single reason to care about them or anything that happens to them. And so when you find certain things happen to them in the denouement of the film, you're largely thinking, meh, is it going to end soon? Rather than, aw, or yay, you know? I realise that wasn't particularly eloquent, but I shall carry on. And just the performances were wooden, although that's largely because the characters and the scenes were so underwritten. But disappointing, probably the worst performance from Vanessa Redgrave, who turns up in the last 10 minutes that I have ever seen. It's like she knew the script wasn't any good, so didn't bother to turn up herself.
As is her wont. I will never, ever watch this film for one reason, and it sounds like this.
Welcome, Kyra Knightley, to the podcast. Good to hear from you. Oh, cripes, it was Craig.
Yeah, so... Also, if you want people to stand around acting like typical, stereotypical, repressed English people
from the upper class.
Then she and McAvoy do an admirable job. But it's not entertaining, it gives them nothing to do. The characters are underwritten, nobody turns up to bother acting. It's almost as bad as Nick Cage and Ghost Rider.
Yes, not one person dives backwards over a table firing two handguns.
I know, it's shocking, isn't it? What's the word coming
Russ
to?
Russ Abbott, isn't it, in it?
I guess I want to reiterate, Vanessa Redgrave, a legendary actress, and I've never seen her come close to being this poor. And just I thought the whole film was a bust. I was very, very disappointed by it.
Got to say, I'm not really going to argue with it too much because it's only scraping the barrel of being kind of passable in my book anyway.
Does it have a hunchback in it?
There are no hunchbacks.
Or flipper babies, unfortunately.
Oh.
Although, strangely, no giraffes show up. Which is normally the cue for us to stop watching a film. Not a great film. Certainly, anyone who even thinks about putting this in a best film category is clearly insane, which would be every film festival, I guess, so far. But they're all wrong. It's not a great film by any stretch of anyone's imagination.
They're all very, very wrong. Even I'm Not There is better than Atonement.
Does it have an orangutan wielding a meat cleaver?
No.
Oh.
No monkeys of any sort, robot or otherwise.
Have you been watching orangutans with meat cleavers again?
No. Yes.
It's the animal follow-up to Bum Fight.
The film where people run towards each other backwards.
That's Bum Run.
Oh,
Bum's Rush.
Bum Race 2000. Yes, I'm entirely in agreement with you, having not seen the film. It is a bust. Which ironically means it's not head and shoulders above every other film. Sorry.
Why is that ironic?
Because of what a bust is in statue terms.
Oh, sorry. I was thinking of, you know, busts as in boobies.
It's always a good thing to think of, and certainly better than that film.
Boobies.
Can I review a joke I heard recently?
Review it. Go for it. Do it.
A guy walks into a bar and asks the barmaid for a double entendre, so she gives him one.
You only heard that recently.
Yes. Two monkeys two monkeys are in a bath, and one says to the other, and the second monkey says, "Well, turn the cold tap on then." What other films have I not seen this week, guys? Or recently, this is a catch-up podcast, isn't it?
Certainly is.
Oh, bottom of the class. I'm sorry, I must apologise. I'm not even unprepared. I've made no attempt to prepare whatsoever.
You saw the preparation mountain and thought, I'm not scaling that one, I'm going around it.
Well, at this point, I feel compelled to apologise to regular listeners if there are such things. I've been experiencing difficult times in my working life recently, and it's not even that I haven't had the inclination, I quite literally have not had the time to watch any of these films, so I can contribute nothing other than facile, childish comments.
Which are always welcome around here.
Idiotic observations based on nothing other than speculation on my part.
Which, to be fair, is normally better than you get from me, so we can't really complain too much.
Oh, okay. But I like those jokes. They're my friends now.
In a seamless link, Drew, why don't you talk about Away From Her?
Yes, what an awesome segue into that. I'm still thinking about that monkey joke, and I don't want to laugh, but I have to.
I'm still thinking about busts. Busts.
Did you hear the one about Bill and Ben in the bath?
I did not.
Can we keep it that way?
No. Oh, if you must.
Oh, go on, say it. You've left it hanging like a black cloud above us.
It's the elephant in the room. Let's mention it.
Bill and Ben are in the bath, and Bill says, "Huffalubalubalubalub." And Ben says, "If you loved me, you'd swallow that."
Ha, ha, ha. Drew, about Away From Her.
Yes, Scott, Away From Her is the debut feature by Canadian director Sarah Polley. Based on Alice Munro's short story The Bear Came Over the Mountain, it tells the story of a married couple, Grant and Fiona Anderson, played by Gordon Pinston and Julie Christie, who, after more than 40 years together, are being forced apart by the pernicious force that is Alzheimer's disease. As Fiona's disease progresses, she and Grant decide, though he reluctantly so, that the best thing for her is to be admitted to a nursing home where she can be cared for fully, and perhaps spare her husband the physical and emotional stress associated with the full-time care of a loved one with such a horrible disease. One of the rules of the nursing home where Fiona is to stay is that there be no contact with anyone from outside, including her husband, for the first 30 days of her stay. This is said to be to make it easier for the patients to adjust to their new environment, though managing nurse Christy, played by Kirsten Thompson, suggested this perhaps instead to make life easier for the staff. In their 44-year marriage, Grant and Fiona have never been apart for as long as 30 days, and he leaves her very reluctantly. So returning to the home 30 days later, he receives a body blow. Fiona barely remembers him and is showing a great deal of affection to another resident of the home, Aubrey, and Grant must now come to terms not only losing his wife, but watch her fall in love with another man. This is another one of those films. It's quite a good film. And performances, for the most part, they're pretty good. And, you know, you're not going to regret watching it. But it's yet another one. It's like, an Oscar contender? Really? Why?
Understandably, it's not exactly a laugh riot, is it?
No, certainly not.
Another one of the watch in two parts efforts. So this time, not because it was making me angry, but because it was making me want to slip my wrists.
I certainly feel quite that bad myself from someone sitting, but it's not the happiest film I've ever seen.
Alzheimer's, one of those conditions you can point at to easily disprove the existence of a kind and benevolent God.
Yeah, and another disease that you really should be held up there is something to say that euthanasia is an awesome idea. Why isn't it law?
A nasty, horrible, crushing disease, and anyone whose family is afflicted by it has my genuine and deepest sympathy, and it's possibly the only thing that actually scares me. The thought of losing control of my mind is the only thing that actually scares me in this world.
I've felt like that a long time too.
I watched my granddad of it.
It's horrible, horrible. And I can see, given the sensitive performances from Christie and Pinsent, why people may have affection for it, but to be honest, this quickly established itself as being less about the characters involved in the story as focusing on the condition that they suffer about. And I already know about that, so my attention tended to wander, so perhaps I'm missing any subtle nuances. But
I wouldn't say, not the performances I have a problem with most, it's more how the characters were written and their responses. I think because, I mean, it's such a horrendous disease, I don't think it was quite enough of the shocking, outrageous, very hurtful behaviour so often exhibited by people suffering from it. And while the film's kind of thought-provoking, and I thought, you know, like you, Scott, it's the only thing that's ever scared me disease-wise is dementia or any of that sort of range of diseases, not knowing who you are and losing your personality. And it certainly gets you thinking about that and issues like euthanasia. But as far as the film goes, I mean, the performances are good, but Julie Christie's character really, she seems to be not having that bad a time with it, which is certainly not the reality for most people. And I didn't need to overplay it, but perhaps some more of the distress that the patient might feel not being able to remember things read more of your show. And also to her husband, I just felt too sanguine.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I kind of took from it more than anything else. I thought it was a film that was less about the suffering of the person with Alzheimer's as those around them. It's the effect on the family and whatnot that it seemed to be driving more at. I think it focused more on the husband's plight than the wife's. But he just didn't seem that afflicted by it. I mean, obviously he's sad, but he should have been destroyed by this.
Yeah,
but
he
wasn't.
Not so much. I mean, you expect perhaps he would break down in tears, or if not that, it's just he was so sanguine. I was like, I couldn't believe they went the whole film without just losing it once, being really, really angry. I mean, not necessarily anybody in particular, just the whole unfairness of it, which is how so many people must see it.
Yeah.
And just wanting to kick things or shoot something or punch something, anything, just to show that he was actually feeling some sort of emotion, bar the occasional sad look in his face.
Well, that's
again,
exactly
his performance wasn't bad. It's just the character wasn't written properly.
That's why I said it was. I felt it focused far more on the condition rather than the people that have it. It's simply saying that, oh look, Alzheimer's exists, but I know this.
Yeah.
And it didn't give me any reason to really care about these particular characters over anyone else who has Alzheimer's in the world and their families.
Yeah, and even then, it's not even that it was focusing so much on disease, because it missed out a lot of the things that make it so hard to deal with. I mean, simple things like, although he wasn't caring for her in his own home, so perhaps not quite so appropriate, but the deterioration of a body that comes about and simple bodily functions and not being able to dress oneself that people need help with. I mean, that sort of thing that over years really gets to people, and there was none of that. It was a good film, and you know, quite touching moments, but there wasn't enough of anything there.
Again, this is why I say it. It's another Wee Gold Man film about people with mental illness, and you always get a lot of Wee Gold Man films with people with mental illness for some reason. Oscars love mental illness for whatever reason, but I don't think this film's anything like good enough to be an Oscar-worthy contender.
I mean, and the story has been covered in other films before, and there's one film in particular, it's a 1985 TV movie with Joanne Woodward, Paul Newman's wife, called Do You Remember Love, which did a far, far better job of covering it. And unfortunately, it's a TV movie and very hard to get. But if you're interested in seeing a film about this topic, then I would look out, see if you could find that perhaps on your TV provider at some point instead. And it's another of these films, you're not going to regret seeing it, but you're certainly going to be left wondering, what was all the fuss about?
If I'm honest, I was kind of bored by most of this film. But personally, I would not recommend it at all. Sorry.
I have to apologise.
Well, some people may be hurt by this. I don't know who. So yeah, not a resounding recommendation, I guess.
What other stuff didn't I see?
Well, I shall talk for a little bit about The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. I don't believe Drew's seen this film, so I'll just rattle on. There was a young man who had a stroke. Haven't we all, though? Ooh, matron. No, not that kind of stroke. Jean-Dominique Jeandeau-Bobby, played by Matthew Alimarik, suffers a stroke resulting in locked-in syndrome, which sort of sucks. He's completely paralysed, barring one eye, although his brain soldiers gamely on. With the help of a speech therapist, he dictates his memoirs by blinking as the glamorous assistant speaks aloud the alphabet. These memoirs are published, are well-regarded, and then turned into this film, which is pretty much your detailed plot recap, although it rather sells it short. Jean-Dominique describes his situation with touching grace, and his imaginative shrapnel of his internal worlds are quite affecting. I can't help but feel that it would be a far better book than a film, though, although I'm making this assertion from a position of near-total ignorance, as usual. Perhaps most baffling is the appearance of Max von Sydow, inasmuch as he does not play an evil villain intent on destroying the world.
What?
Not that we're saying he's typecast. In Rush Hour 3, he turns out to be a triad boss. Triad bosses generally notable for being, well, Asian, and Max von Sydow often being commented upon as being not Asian.
Notably so.
Rather unfortunately, at least for someone recording a podcast, I can't think of much to say about this film, apart from the fact that I rather like it. Touching performance, largely in voiceover from Matthew Alimarik, and the film shows a commendable visual flair that holds interest well, despite the lead character sadly being less dynamic than your usual lead. There's the odd heavy-handed visual metaphor, which seems rather at odds with the delicacy with which much of the rest is handled. I kind of understand the butterfly part of this title without being so bludgeoned with it, thank you so very much. But it is definitely one of the more deserving Oscar contenders. It's heartily recommended from here. Try and seek it out if you can.
Oh, I've not seen it, so I can't really say much. It's a bit different in that he could speak, but I suppose it draws parallels from what you've said about it, of Carter not being the most active in lying there. It reminds me a bit of The Sea Inside. Is it anything like that at all?
Yes, it kind of has elements of it. I've got to admit, I can't remember The Sea Inside well enough to give you much of an example. But yeah, it is similar from what I recall. For some reason, it also put me in mind of the Barbarian Invasions, but I can't quite justify that in any kind of way other than it just sort of made that connection within my crazily addled neurons.
Presumably better than the Barbarian Invasions was, though.
Yes, less shouty and Canadian. It's just always a good thing. That's a rather lame note to end things on. I could talk about Beaufort if you like. Would you like that?
Beaufort T. Justice.
Beaufort T. Justice. Yes. No, Beaufort. The
or
film.
Beaufort T. Windscale.
What about Beaufort T. Hedgehog?
Nah, let's just stick to the film.
I don't really know quite what to make of Beaufort. When I was coming to write some notes for this little spiel, I wrote the sentence below saying, I don't know quite what to make of this film, and went away for a couple of days to consider my position, and I'm still none the wiser. I don't really know what it was trying to say. Very roughly, it chronicles the story of a young army officer in the Israeli army charged with guarding the titular Beaufort, a Lebanese mountaintop fortification existing in some form or other since medieval times. The IDF have decided to pull out of the area, so while he's risking the lives of his men by putting them at the explodey end of Hezbollah rockets, occasionally fired at the guard posts, he's also preparing to pull everyone and their equipment out of the fort won from Hezbollah decades ago at no small cost of life. It's not an awful lot to hang a film on, at least as it's shown here, and despite the conflict outside the fort, there's very little inside it. For the most part, Beaufort seems to dance around issues rather than address them, and while solving the Middle East's troubled political situation would be somewhat outside the scope of a two-hour film, perhaps mentioning them may have been prudent. It may perhaps be one of those films that are content simply to show a slice of life from one perspective and encourage you to quietly go off and think about things on your own time as homework, but I'm struggling to see exactly what I'm supposed to be thinking about. Maybe it's about the futility of wars over transient lines on maps, but it's not exactly much use of a polemic if you can't really tell what's being polemic is eyes-ated, or whatever the word for that is. At any rate, there's nothing outstandingly terrible about Beaufort, but I can't think of anything outstandingly fabulous about it either. It's in no way, shape, outstanding at all. It's almost resolutely slouched in posture. A mere handful of days after watching the film, I struggled to recall any details from it, which is probably a neater recap of how attention-grabbing and memorable this film isn't as any other. In conclusion, meh.
It seems to have summed up a number of the films we've talked about tonight too, meh.
I've got to admit, right, I am hugely disappointed. I thought, with the films of late being somewhat crappy, going back to look at the things that have been voted by people who ought to know as being the best films of the year should at least result in watching a few decent films. And there's, what, two actually good films in that list that we've done so far? Out of seven? That's not a good hit race.
It would seem the reason we missed these the first time round is because they weren't that great.
Well, quite a lot of them hadn't been released or were on limited release, but even then, they're just simply not the sort of calibre of films you would expect to find in an Oscar ceremony.
Yeah, and there, you may not agree with all the Oscar choices, but I mean, at least you'd expect perhaps four out of five, even three out of the five in a bad year to at least be decent films, as opposed to one out of the five. It's crazy.
Yeah, I'm massively disconcerted by this. It's either the industry has completely gone down the toilet, or just that certain people are getting better at bribing certain judges than anything else.
Well, no, it's just a case of the industry going down the toilet, because regardless of the calibre of films that year, they still have to pick a certain number to put forward as Oscar contenders. They can't just say, well, we're not going to have the Oscars this year because, frankly, there's the competition's not strong enough.
Well, that's not necessarily the case, though, because, you know, I mean, like, it's not quite the same in that there's far fewer of them released, but when it comes to the best animation feature, there's generally only three in it because they think, oh, there's not really enough to challenge it. They could just do that. There's precedent for it within their own awards.
Mm-hmm. But maybe that's more of a reflection of the view they take on animation as a cinematic form as opposed to live action. I don't know.
It's possible.
Well, wasn't this another year where they're making up the numbers? Wasn't Surf's Up put up for an Oscar?
The point is, if they'd been narrowing numbers down, There Will Be Blood would be the only film forward for best film. But as it happens, clearly the best film of the year didn't win.
No.
Yeah, at least they got the actor award, but still, it's just a crime that that didn't win.
Oh, I drink their milkshake.
So I think the consensus is that 2007 was wrong.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very impressively so. 2007 sucked.
Rather hope that 2008 would be a bright new dawn, but it doesn't seem to have been such, has it?
Well, we've managed five good films this year so far, and it's the end of April. That's not a good record.
No, especially given that the first couple of months of the year are generally have a fairly high concentration of
award-debating contenders
that didn't make it out last year here, but we're about to descend into the summer season, which I dare say we'll have some enjoyable films, but I don't think it's going to have any classics.
Am I the only one who's actually quite looking forward to Iron Man?
I wasn't the first couple of trailers, but the second trailer that actually showed some story, I'm looking much forward to it much more now.
Robert Downey Jr. looks like he's going to be absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, well, Robert Downey Jr. is great. And every film I've seen him in recently has been great, and even if the film itself hasn't been that awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do not know what that man has done, but since he got off the crack, I mean, I'd barely heard of the man until things like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang came out.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang was fantastic.
It's a fantastic film. It's a brilliant film. If anyone's not seen it, definitely go out and see that. Things like A Scanner Darkly, which, incidentally, while I mention it, there's a film that was overlooked. I think just because the rotoscoping thing seems to have overarched everything else, and the people just went,
yeah,
"Oh, that's
gimmick."
Yeah,
we can't take it seriously.
A Scanner Darkly is a fantastic film.
Certainly
anyone who's not seen that needs to go out and see that immediately.
And it finishes on a classic Tom York song as well.
Certainly one of the better films I've seen in the last few years, and it really deserves a lot more attention than it got, which was to be politely ignored by everybody.
Yeah, it was I might even go so far as to say it's the best adaptation I've seen of a Philip Dick story, to be honest.
Yeah, certainly one in terms of anything that has any resemblance to what it originally was in the first place.
Most faithful to the source material, because although obviously I would tell you I prefer Blade Runner as a film overall, I'm not going to pretend I don't, but it's not as faithful to the source material as Scanner Darkly is, and it was absolutely fantastic. I'd forgotten all about it, to be honest. And you can pick it up for a good £3-4, I believe, on DVD.
You can get Kiss Kiss Bang Bang for that price too, and
yeah, exactly.
I'd pay more than that, quite often did, in fact, but it's crazy to have that film at that price and not own it, because Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is a gem.
In general, I don't really sort of necessarily look forward to all the superhero stuff and the comic book stuff. I mean, I'm looking forward to the next Batman film, but that's...
Spider-Man 3 pretty much disabused us of that notion, didn't it?
That's more because I'm a Christian Bale fan than a Batman fan. But I have to say, from the more recent sort of trailers and footage sort of released from Iron Man, it seems to actually be... Well, I hate to say it, but it looks like it could end up being quite perfectly pitched and not taking itself too seriously. And Robert Downey Jr. just looks like he's having a blast in it. So,
yeah, I think he could even make up for the presence of Gwyneth Paltrow.
Quite possibly.
Such is the man's acting prowess.
Looking forward to that. Looking forward to Indiana Jones. I don't know. There's some other stuff coming out. I'm sure it'll probably be quite entertaining. So I don't think this year can be much worse than last year.
It'd be quite a challenge, quite an impressive achievement if it was. So let's hope they doesn't meet that.
No, absolutely. Okay, guys, well, can't claim to have contributed much to any of this at all, but thanks for listening. I promise next time that I won't let work get in the way of my desire to furnish you with my somewhat limited opinions on cinematic offerings of the past few weeks. I have always have been Craig Eastman, coming to you from just outside Liverpool in Glasgow, Scott Morris.
Goodbye.
And in Falkirk, Drew Tarrendale.
Goodbye.
We will speak to you again soon, and keep it real.
Doobity-doo, doobity-doo. Doobity-doo, doobity-doo, doo-doo-doobity-doo, yeah.